الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الكريم وعلى آله وأصحابه ومن استنى بسنة ليوم الدين. All praise is due to Allah and may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. As brother as introduced, the topic is on slander in the Quran. And in fact, what we'll be looking at is a particular chapter of the Quran, the 104th chapter of the Quran, which is called the chapter Al-Humaza. And Humaza means slanderer. So this chapter of the Quran, a short chapter of only 9 verses, deals with the slanderer. What are the attributes of the slanderer? What is their end? And the purpose for this chapter being dedicated to this particular topic is that in the early days of Islam, when Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, began to proclaim the message of the unity of God in Arabia, at a time when people had taken many other gods besides the true God. They had taken gods as intercessors between themselves and God. They had taken gods besides God, whom they would worship instead of God. This had become the norm for religion in Arabia. Though we know that from the time of Prophet Abraham, when he took his wife Hagar and his daughter Ishmael and left them in Mecca in Arabia, the seeds of the Unitarian teachings regarding God, that God is one, the seeds were planted at that time. Prophet Abraham came back to visit his son Ishmael and built there the first house of worship dedicated to the worship of one true God. And Prophet Ishmael, like Prophet Isaac, taught this message of the oneness of God, that only God alone deserves to be worshipped. However, in time in Arabia, generations after the time of Prophet Ishmael, idolatry found its way back amongst the people. Until the time when Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, was chosen to be the last prophet of God to proclaim this message, this Unitarian message of the one God alone deserves to be worshipped. By his time, idolatry had spread all over Arabia. And even the message which had been reinforced generation after generation from the time of Prophet Isaac had in the Middle East, in Palestine, in Rome, in Turkey, and in southern Europe, by the 8th century, it had become distorted. The oneness of God was still spoken about there. Idolatry was not openly practiced, but God had become three. A God who was one, but yet he was three. So the message of Prophet Isaac, even in those areas, had become distorted. And idolatry was being introduced through the process known as icons, religious statues. So people would have in their homes, in their places of worship, whatever, they would have these little religious objects, either statues or paintings. This is the process of idolatry working its way in, which was against the teachings of Jesus, as well as against the teachings of Moses and Abraham. Because the graven image is something which has been prohibited in the Ten Commandments without any shadow of a doubt. Graven images. In any case, when Prophet Muhammad began to proclaim the message of Prophet Abraham, of Moses, and of Jesus, he found great opposition, as all the prophets before found opposition. And the small band of followers who accepted that message and tried to live in accordance with that message, they came under constant attack by the idolaters, those who were involved in the worship of gods besides the true God. The attack sometimes was physical. The believers in the early years in Mecca were tortured. Some of them were tortured to death for their belief. At other times, it was psychological. They were referred to in the most horrible of terms. Lies, slander was spread about them. And about the Prophet himself, though he was known prior to the revelation to be an extremely honest and trustworthy person, his title or his nickname, he used to be called Al-Amin. Al-Amin means the trustworthy one. One whom they used to leave, the people of Mecca used to leave their anything of value which they wanted to keep, to have, you know, instead of, because they didn't have banks, right? They would, in those days, whatever things that they had of importance, they would leave it in trust with somebody, you know, a person who was considered to be the trustworthy one amongst them. And it was Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, with whom these things were left. However, once he started to call people to the oneness of God, all of a sudden, the people no longer trusted him. They started to tell stories about him, tell lies about him. They claimed he was mad. They claimed he was possessed. And because of the effects of the Quran on people, people who would listen to the Quran would be so deeply affected, drawn to Islam, they claimed that he was a magician. That the Quran which he had, this scripture which he had, was really magical formulas which were capturing people. Now perhaps some of you can just come and sit, because we're short of chairs, and leave the chairs back for the women, you know. So, at that time, this process of slander, of making up terrible stories about the Prophet as well as his followers, his disciples, had become intense. It had And naturally it would have an effect on both the Prophet and his companions. Of course, it didn't cause them to give up the message, passing on this message. However, naturally there would be pain. No one likes to be slandered. No matter how much you feel that you are on a truthful path, that what you are doing is correct, if your relatives or your friends, former friends, etc., begin to slander you, it hurts. So Allah the Almighty reveals this chapter of 9 verses to let the believers know that they should not worry or feel despair, because ultimately success will come to those who follow the true path, those who hold firmly to the truth. They will be ultimately successful. And those who are involved in slander, etc., telling lies about the believers, they are the ones on the Day of Judgment who will be the losers. This is the basic message of this chapter. It also describes characteristics of the disbelievers who slander the believers, in order that the believers would themselves avoid these characteristics, and that those who disbelieve may reflect on the negative aspects of these characteristics and perhaps change. So the chapter begins. وَيْلٌ لِكُلِّ هُمَزَةٍ لُمَزَةٍ. The curse of God is on every slandering backbiter. All who commit slander and backbiting are cursed. Evil is cursed. No matter how much evil may seem to be successful in this life, we see those people who are involved in evil, cheating, lying, stealing, etc., they may appear to be successful in this life. However, they are cursed. Cursed in this life, to us, we know it means a person seems to be getting away with things for some time, and then you see their lives become terrible. In the end, things become terrible. They don't escape. Even if they may appear to us to die in their beds, comfortable deaths, nothing seems to happen to them, the reality is otherwise. The next life they have destroyed for themselves. They may have enjoyed some things in this life, but the reality is that the next life has been destroyed. Okay, it seems no more people are coming, so if you want to go back and sit, take it like this. Go ahead. Go ahead. Now, there are common misconceptions about what is backbiting and what is slander, in fact. So, Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, corrected for the believers the misconceptions that commonly arise. He said to his companions, his disciples, on one occasion, "Do you know what backbiting is?" And they said to him, they replied to him, "Allah and His Messenger knows best." They didn't want to give their opinion. They wanted to hear from the source of revelation what in fact is backbiting. Because the very fact that the Prophet asked them, do you know what backbiting is? And they all had an idea what backbiting was. The fact that he's asking them, it means that it is not what they're thinking. So they said, Allah and His Messenger knows best. So he said, it is mentioning something about your brother which he does not like. It is saying something about somebody else which they wouldn't like to be said. At that point, his disciples, his companions, raised their doubts. And they asked him, but what if what we said was true? What if what we said was true? Because in their minds, if you're telling the truth about people, even though they don't like to hear it said, then this is not backbiting. You're telling the truth. So he said, that is backbiting. When what you say about your brother or sister, not in their presence, which they wouldn't like this thing said, and it's true, that is backbiting. Sinful. And he said, if what you said was not true, that is slander, an even bigger sin. So he clarified for the believers what in fact is slander and what is backbiting. What does Islam consider to be sinful with regards to talking about others? Very important, because people are always talking about others. If you listen to people's conversations, the average conversation is talking about other people. Mostly. And if you analyze what people are saying, it's not good things. It's all things that people would not like said. 99%. It's either jealousy, you know, so-and-so has this, I wish I had so-and-so, they don't deserve it, I should have it. It's either that kind of talk, or it is, you know, so-and-so, they're doing this and they're doing that, and they got this and that. This is the normal talk. And this is something that believers, those who believe in God, have to beware. The Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, said, whoever believes in God and the last day, on the day of judgment, that they will have to stand to account for what happens in this life, whoever believes truly in God and the last day, they should either speak good things or be silent. If you don't have something good to say, then it is better to be silent. Why? Because every word that comes out of your mouth, you will have to stand to account for on the day of judgment. God will ask you why you said this and why you said that. So if one truly believes, see, if one is speaking, if one says, oh, I believe in God, I'm a true believer, but they're saying this, saying that, how? You don't believe that you'll have to answer to God for what you're saying? You see, there is belief in words when a person says, I believe, and then there's real belief, that belief which affects their actions and causes them to act in accordance with that belief. The true believer will avoid saying these things. The true believer will stop others from saying these things. So this is a means of checking ourselves. To what degree do we believe in a judgment in God? Because belief in God is belief in the judgment. To what degree do we believe? If the belief doesn't affect our actions, then the belief is not real. It is only knowledge. You may know about God. You may know about the Day of Judgment. But that knowledge is not translated into belief until you act in accordance with that knowledge. This is the Islamic perspective on belief. Belief is not just something in the heart. It is in the heart and in the actions. The two have to be there. That real belief is manifest in actions. It must show up in good deeds that the person does. It is not just words to say, I believe. In fact, those who say, I believe, but their actions are contrary to that belief, such Allah calls the hypocrites, al-munafiquna. And Allah says about the hypocrites, إِنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ فِي الدَّرْكِ الْأَسْفَلِ مِنَ النَّارِ. Verily, surely, indeed, the hypocrites will be in the lowest levels of the hellfire. Means those who said, I believe, but it was a lie. It was only I know, but I'm not living according to it. I'm living my own life. Those people, though they said, I'm a Muslim, or I'm a follower of Jesus, or I'm a follower of Moses, those people will be the fuel for the hellfire. So, backbiting is saying about people what they would not like said, even though it is the truth. Islam teaches us to avoid this. However, there are circumstances in which this is permitted. Islam, a religion which covers all aspects of human life, takes into account the circumstances where it may be necessary to say the truth about people which they would not like said. And the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, demonstrated that to his companions, that there are times when it becomes necessary. One of those critical times is at a time of marriage. That is, not meaning that the guy who plans to marry tells lies or tries to hide things from his intended wife, etc. No. It means that if a woman is going to get married, and in Islam, she is enjoined to take advice from her relatives and those people, friends who are in the know, who know the people who they intend to marry. If a woman comes and asks about a person who she intends to marry, the person who was proposed to her, then it is the duty of those who are asked to give full information about this person, because this is a woman's future. Similarly, it is a man's future. If a man asks for information, it is the duty of others to inform him about that person. The truth. If there are things which they need to know. For example, when one of the female companions of the Prophet, her name was Fatima, the daughter of Qais, She came to Prophet Muhammad and she said to him, two people have proposed marriage to me, Abu Sufyan and Amr ibn al-As. What should I do? The Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, he told her, Abu Sufyan is stingy. Stingy means he doesn't give out his money very easy. He's very tight with his money. Stingy. Right? It's not a nice, it's true, but not a nice thing to say about people. Right? So and so is stingy. You know, it's not a nice thing to say. But the woman came and she wanted this information. So the Prophet informed her. This is a characteristic. So you know when you're marrying this person, you're marrying a stingy person. You know, if you don't mind marrying him and he's stingy, okay. But be aware that he is stingy. He's tight with his money. He will hardly give you enough that you need. Why? Because one of the other wives of Abu Sufyan, she had come to the Prophet and asked him. She said, Abu Sufyan is so stingy, I don't have enough money for myself and our children. Is it okay for me to take some of his money without him knowing? To steal from my husband? The Prophet said, you may take as much as you need. He gave her permission to take from her husband without his knowledge. Right? Because it's her right. She's not stealing in the sense of stealing. It is her right to have enough to maintain herself and her children. So he permitted her to take as much as she needs, not meaning that she goes and takes and then she's taking more and buying, you know, fancy this and no. Just take as much as she needs. So the Prophet knew about Abu Sufyan. As for Amr, he said to her, Amr beats his women. When he gets upset at his wife, he hits her. Okay? So be aware. You know, this is not a pleasant circumstance. If you don't mind being beaten by your husband, then go ahead, you can marry Amr. Okay? Again, this is not a nice thing to say about people. He also beats his wife, you know. But the Prophet informed her. Why? Because this is her future. This is who she's going to marry, somebody with these bad characteristics. You know, she should be aware. Instead, he said to her, it would be better if you married Usama. Usama was the son of a slave, former slave, who had been freed by the Prophet and who had become like his adopted son, Zayd. And Usama was the son of Zayd. Now, in those days, people, as in these days, are concerned about family. You know, status. When you marry, you try to marry somebody from a high status in society, from a well-known family, well-to-do, you know, having famous from generations. So, naturally, people have these desires to marry somebody who was the son of a slave, former slave. This is something which, you know, emotionally, psychologically, people would not want to do. However, the Prophet taught that people are married for four basic reasons. For their wealth, they have a lot of money. For their beauty, they're handsome or beautiful. For their family, they're from a big family, rich family, well-known family. And for their piety. He said, marry the one who is pious and you will be successful. So the basis for the choice in Islam, the fundamental basis, is piety. When a person is choosing a husband or a wife, Islam says, choose somebody who is God-fearing. This is the best husband or wife you can find for yourself. Somebody who fears God. Guess what Islam says? If they fear God and have a lot of money and are handsome from a good family, okay, alhamdulillah, you got everything. You know, most times people don't have all these things. But most important thing, if we have to choose because of one characteristic, if we're to look at what is the most important characteristic, it should be the fear of God. So he told her, better you marry Usama, because Usama was a God-fearing man. So Fatima said, I married Usama and was happy. She took the advice of the Prophet. So on the circumstances of marriage, it is the duty of those who have knowledge about somebody who is to be married to inform the partner of that person. Similarly, in business contracts, if a person comes to me and says to me, well listen, you know, I'm planning to go into this business deal with so and so, what's your opinion? Now I know last year I had a business deal with so and so and he ripped me off. The business failed, he took all the money, he didn't pay back, and you know, I had a bad experience with this person. Now it is my duty to tell that person who is about to get into this business deal with the person about my experience. This is not considered to be backbiting in Islam. Because your intention is to protect another person from harm, which is different from when you had that bad experience with the individual, then you just go bad-mouthing that person around to everybody. Oh, so-and-so is a this, and he's a that, and he's a that. Just talking. Because your intention there is not to protect others. Your intention is just to revenge. You try to get back at this person by just telling things about this person. See, so this is evil. But where your intention is the protection of the rights of others, then it is permissible. With regards to slander, that is now telling lies about others, this is an even greater sin in Islam. It is a sin where if a person says about another person, so and so is fornicating with so and so, she's living with this guy and doing this and doing that, or he's living with this woman doing this and doing that. If a person says this in Islamic law and a complaint is raised to the courts, then the judge will ask that person to produce 4 witnesses who observed this person in the act. Not 4 people who heard the rumor, but 4 people who saw this man and woman committing fornication. And if that person cannot produce 4 witnesses, then they are given 80 lashes publicly. They're taken before the community and are beaten, given 80 strokes of the cane. Because people have a right that their honor not be destroyed by others. And of course, from Islamic perspective, fornication is a major sin, is a serious sin. A person who is involved in fornication, according to Islamic law, if they are caught, evidence is brought, they are punished 100 lashes publicly, male and female. If they're involved in adultery, that is either one of them was married or had been married, then the punishment is death, stoning to death. And this is the punishment not introduced by Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him. He didn't make up this punishment. This was the punishment which is recorded in the laws from the time of Moses and before. that the adulterer and the adulteress should be stoned to death. Today, this is called free love. It is something which is condoned by most societies around the world. In any case, the point is that Islam takes a very strong position against backbiting and slander. And in order to even make it psychologically more detestable in the minds of the believers, in the 49th chapter of the Quran, verse 12, Allah said, "Do not backbite each other. Would any of you like to eat the flesh of his dead brother? You would dislike it." God compared backbiting, this is telling the truth about others, that they wouldn't like, said, He compared it to eating the flesh of your dead brother. Something revolting. And this is how we should feel. The same way if somebody offered us a piece of our dead brother's flesh and said, "Have a meal, have a bite," we would be revolted, we'd be sick to our stomachs. The same way that we feel, if that happened, we should feel if somebody encourages us to backbite. Or if we hear other people backbiting. Of course, the worst level of slander, we talked about the punishment in this life for those who commit slander against innocent people. The worst level of slander that mankind can commit is to say there is no God. Or to say God has partners. He has a father or a son, a mother or a daughter. This is the greatest level of slander that a human being can commit. Because it's a slander against God. To slander each other is one thing. It's horrible. Punishment in this life and punishment in the next life too, possibly. But God can forgive us these things. He can forgive us. If we slander each other, but we do other good deeds, etc., it is possible for Him to forgive us those sins. But if we slander God and die in a state of slandering God, there is no forgiveness. This is why God said in the 4th chapter of the Quran, verse 84 and verse 116. Verily, Allah does not forgive making shirk, that is, slandering God by saying He doesn't exist, or that He has father, son, brother, sister, daughter, whatever. But He forgives anything less than that for whomsoever He pleases. Any sin which is less than that sin, if we die in that state without asking God's forgiveness, God can forgive us that sin. But if we die in a state of slandering God, saying He doesn't exist, or that He has a son, then that sin will not be forgiven. That sin will put us in hell forever. That is how serious the sin is. Unfortunately, so many people today, they don't realize it. They don't realize the seriousness of the sin of saying that God has a son. So this is the warning. To say that God doesn't exist, like the communists, the materialists, certain scientists, famous for this. We're here by accident. We are children of the ape. Our great-great-grandparent was a monkey. Climbed out of a tree and then started walking. All of this to say that there is no God. I mean, that's what's behind all of it. It may sound kind of reasonable when they show you all these bones and all these other things, but if you try to see beyond what they're saying, what they're actually telling you is, there is no God. We are just here by accident. And that, like the slander of saying that God has a son, or that God is a man, or was a man, or an animal. You have people who say God became a cow, you know, and they worship cows. God became an elephant, they worship elephants. God became a tree, and they worship trees. This is all great slander against God. But it is no less great than saying that God became a man. That is just as great a slander. To say that the creator of this universe became his creation. It is illogical, it is nonsense, and it is a lie against God. God is God. And whatever is besides God is his creation. Everything which is not God, he created. Allah goes on in the second verse to say, الَّذِي جَمَعَ مَالًا وَعَدَّدَ, describing the slanderer. He gathers wealth and is always counting. The person who slanders the believers, who doesn't believe in a judgment, who believes that this life is all that there is, it's only about having a good time. If you want to have a good time, then you got to have money. This is what we are told. You watch the television, you read the newspapers, the magazines. Those who are having a good time are those who have money. Pop stars, you know, athletes, the rich and the famous. They're the ones having the good time. So, if we want to have a good time, then we have to get this money. And to get this money, we have to get it by any means. Because that's what life's about. When you don't accept God, when you laugh at those who believe, then your focus is on money. Money becomes your God. And as the true believer would do anything for God, anything that God commands them to do, they would do. The one who worships money will do anything for money. Anything to get that money means they will cheat, they will steal, they will lie, they will, anything. They don't realize that the more money you have, the more money you want. You never reach a state where you say, ah, I have all the money I need. No! As the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, said, if a man was given a valley of gold, he would want another valley of gold. That is the nature. We never have enough. We always want more. So there is no satisfaction and contentment in wealth and money. Those who spend all their efforts to gather this money, their lives are miserable. You read into the lives of the richest of the people on this earth, and you see their lives are miserable. They're always counting their money. They're always afraid that they will lose their money. And when they look at the people around them, they are afraid that they will try to take this money from them. They can't have friends because everybody who smiles at them, they're thinking,
person's got a plan, trying to get some of my money. They can't trust people. They don't have any trust and confidence in people. There's no contentment in their lives. They're constantly in a state of despair. On the outside, they may try to hoop it up. They disco parties, good time, money, yachts, and all flying around the world, all these things on the outside. But on the inside, they're empty. They're empty. They cannot find satisfaction in wealth. That is real. So what happens? Such a person to whom or for whom life, this life is all that there is, they want to hold on to it at any cost. So Allah said, يَحْسَبُ أَنَّ مَا لَهُ أَخْلَدَ. He thinks that his wealth will make him immortal. He feels that that wealth, the people who are gathering the money, they feel that they can live forever with it. Somehow, they don't have to think about death. This money will always buy the, you know, your heart goes wrong, you can buy another heart. Right? Your liver goes wrong, you can buy another liver. You know, you can always buy body parts to keep yourself together, you know. You can afford to have these operations, whatever. You can live forever. This is the dream. This is what's in the minds of these people. Of course, when the body parts start failing, and they can't get any more body parts to replace, and they start thinking, well, how can I prolong this life at any cost, anyhow, even if I have to die for a moment, how can I come back? So they said, okay, what we have offered in America and in England, we have what they call refrigerated coffins. Right? You don't get buried in the ground now. They have this, you can pay. Like $25,000-$30,000. You can pay to have your body frozen. Liquid nitrogen will freeze your body completely. And they will keep you in these coffins, refrigerated coffins, in which they will, you know, make sure that the nitrogen is always replenished to keep you frozen until a time to come when, well, we can now go to the museum in England, in America, in Egypt, around the world, and we can see their bodies. They're lying there all wrapped up, okay? They didn't make it back. They thought they were going to come back sometime. But there's no coming back. When we leave this world with a one-way ticket. Of course, as I said, people, you know, anything that they can hold on to think that they can come back or there's another chance or whatever, they will reach out for it. Because we all would like to know that we can continue. You know, it's not over once you leave this life. This is why Satan, for some people, puts this idea in their mind that they are reborn. You have 800 million people in India, and Buddhists all around the world, the Hindus and the Buddhists, whether it's in Burma or Thailand, Cambodia and Japan, believing that they will come back. When you die, your soul just goes into another being that is being born. So you really don't die, you're back again. This is a delusion of Satan. Because that's why it doesn't matter in this life. This is why you read every day in the newspaper, you read about this Hindu who tied her neck to a fan and, you know, suicide is easy. It doesn't matter, you get another chance, come back. This is a delusion of Satan. The reality is that when we leave this life, we leave it not to come back to this life. The Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, told us. He said, servants of God, treat each other's sicknesses. When you get sick, develop medicines and treat each other. Because surely God, may he be glorified, has not sent any disease on this earth except that he has sent with this cure. It encourages man to seek the cure for the sicknesses that we find, except for old age. He said that 1,400 years ago. All of the sicknesses, he said, they are cured. Find them, seek them. Islam encourages scientific research, but don't waste your time, fool yourself into thinking that there is a cure for old age and death. There's no cure. Scientists today, you read it in the papers every week, people spending billions of dollars into research in old age, trying to find that particular gene in the chromosomes that make up the human being. That if they can turn off this gene, because they see people, no matter how they, you know, they keep themselves healthy and they do everything, there comes a point in life when the body just starts to break down. No matter what you do, you try more, you change this organ, you know, operations, all, but your body just starts to break down till you die. Nothing, they can't stop it. So it's like there is a clock. There's like a clock in our system that it runs for a period of time. It's like the battery runs out and then the clock stops and you die. So they want to find that clock, that biological clock. How can we keep it wound up, you know, to keep on going? They're spending billions and billions to find this clock. But the Prophet told us 1,400 years ago, you cannot find the clock. Even if you find the clock, you can't wind it back up again. There is no cure for old age. Then it means we have to think about the here and the now. Where are we headed? Is our lives the lives of the slanderers? Those who have slandered God, slandered others, hypocrites, not living in accordance with what we know to be true. Are we sure we'll be around tomorrow or the day after? Who can be sure of that? The only thing we are sure about is we're alive right now. The moment. This is what we are sure about. So it means that we have the duty to make the most of each and every moment. This is what is the way of the wise, the intelligent. Those who recognize the reality of this life, they make the most of the moment. And this desire to live on, as I said, is an ancient desire. A desire which was in the very first man created on this earth, Adam and Eve. They had that desire. It was there inside them. It is part of the desire just to live. If we don't eat, we get hungry, there is something which drives us to eat, to preserve our lives. The desire to live, not to die. This is a natural desire which we have to have in order to preserve life. Where it is preserving life, it is good. But where it is distorted into trying to live forever, it is evil. And Satan plays on this desire. This is why in the Quran, when God describes the circumstance of Adam and Eve, he created them in paradise, and he told them they could do anything here. They could have all of this fruit of this paradise except for the fruit of a particular tree. This was the commandment to them. When they forgot that commandment, and it is a part of the nature of men, of human beings, to forget. We forget sometimes. And Satan comes to you when you forget. He doesn't come when you remember God and remember God's commandments. He comes when you forget God and you forget the commandments. So when they forgot, Satan came to them, as Allah said in the 7th chapter, verse 20, and Satan whispered to them, God only forbade you from eating of the tree so that you would not become like the angels or to live forever. That's what he whispered to them. That eating of the tree would give them everlasting life. And it is out of this desire, having forgotten God, God's commandments, that they went ahead and ate. It's a very dangerous desire. Allah said, كَلَّا لَيُنْبَذَنَّ فِي الْحُطَمَةِ, in the 4th verse. No, those who think that wealth will make them immortal, no, it will not. And they will be thrown into الْحُطَمَةِ. Every soul, Allah said in the 3rd chapter, verse 185, كُلُّ نَفْسٍ ذَائِقَةُ الْمَوْتِ, every soul will taste death. Every soul will taste death. We all will die. And when we die, as I said, there is no coming back. In the 23rd chapter, verse 100, Allah said, and behind them is a partition until the day they are resurrected. When they die, they are blocked from coming back into the world until the day of resurrection. Now, Allah said that He will throw them into Al-Hutama. In Arabic, Al-Hutama, from Hatama, it means to smash something. A smasher, something which will smash you into pieces. But Allah goes on to emphasize, what is this thing that will smash you into pieces? In the 5th verse He said, وَمَا أَدْرَاكَ مَا الْحُطَمَةِ, and what will make you really understand this hutama which will smash you to pieces? He said, نَارُ اللَّهِ الْمُوْقَدَةِ, it is the blazing fire of Allah. It is the fire of Allah. It is the hellfire. A fire which is beyond our comprehension. A fire which will destroy us in a way we cannot even imagine. A fire which is a living creature. Allah describes it in the Quran as a living being. He said in the 67th chapter, verse 7, when they are cast in, when people are cast into hell, they will hear it the drawing in of its breath as it blazes forward. They will hear it as if it is breathing. Like this. They will hear the breath of the hellfire. It is a living creature, like one we have never seen or imagined. And Allah says, one day, this is after the judgment, as people are thrown into hell, I will ask hell, are you full? And hell, the creature hell, will answer, is there more to come? Are there more people to come? There is room. This is the hellfire talking. God relates that to us to remove any possible thoughts in our minds that maybe we are later along the line, hell will get full by the time we come around. By the time our turn comes around to be thrown into hell, it will be full. No! There is no filling hell. If we have chosen a path of slander, of disbelief, of disobedience, then our end is hell. And this hellfire, Allah said in the 7th verse, أَلَّتِي تَطَّلِعُ عَلَى الْأَفْئِدَةِ, which overcomes the heart. Not only does it burn our body, and Allah says elsewhere that it will, the fire will burn off the skin, and Allah will replace it with another skin. Why? Why not just keep burning? Today we know the significance of that. Because once you burn off the skin, this is where all the nerve endings are. Any burning which comes after that, you don't feel anymore. This modern science tells us. Allah spoke about it then. That when the skin is burnt off, you've reached the maximum of pain. You reach the point where the pain becomes no more. You become numb to pain. The skin is given back and it's burnt off again. This is a perpetual state that we'll be in. But this fire will not only burn our skin, create this extreme, excruciating pain, but it will also overcome our hearts. It will go into our bodies and it will burn not only the physical body, but the soul. This is something we can't imagine. Burning the body yet, burning the soul. But this is the hellfire. This is what awaits us. إِنَّهَا عَلَيْهِمْ مُؤْصَدَةً فِي عَمَدٍ مُمَدَّدَةً. It will be tightly closed over them in columns stretching forward. We will be sealed in the hellfire, in columns, no escape. We'll neither be alive, nor we will be dead. Allah says in the 20th chapter, verse 74, for him is hell in which he neither will die nor live. In the 14th chapter, verse 17, and death will come to him from everywhere, yet he will not die. The people in hell will feel as if they're going to die, on the verge of death, but they won't die. They won't feel fully alive and they won't feel dead, just in that state in between. A constant trial, everlasting. Something for us to reflect on. Our end from this life is either paradise or hell. There is no in between. Either paradise or hell. And it depends on our faith and our practice, which reflects that faith. So we have a choice to either do the things which will get us to paradise, which means accepting God in His oneness as the one true God, loving that God with all our hearts and all our souls, taking no other gods beside Him. No God the Father, no God the Son, or God the Holy Ghost. Three gods in one, no. Taking one God. This is the path to paradise. That we take that one God as our Lord. And we love Him with all our hearts and all our souls. Meaning what? That we cry about God at night, we miss God, and you know, like we miss our parents and our... No. To love God is to follow the commandments of God. As Allah said in the Quran, if you seek to love God, then you must follow the messenger of God, and God will love you. As the person in this life who you love, you will do anything for. The thing which you love, you will do anything for it. For God, that love must be greater. The willingness to do anything for God, meaning that whatever God has commanded us, we will do it. Whatever He has prohibited us, we will avoid it. This is how we love God, by obeying God's commandments, confirming the commandments in our lives. This is the path to paradise. This is the path of the prophets. This is what Jesus was saying when he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. This is what he was saying, I am the way. I am showing you the way to paradise. That way begins with accepting one God, worshipping that one God as Jesus did. Not saying that that God had a father, that he had a mother, that he was born on the earth and he was circumcised, he drank milk and he died on a cross. No, this is a slander against God. The way of Jesus, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, is to worship one God as he worshiped. And that is the way to paradise. That is what will give us life everlasting in paradise. And that is the truth. That is the ultimate truth that we all need to realize. If we choose to reject that, we reject the worship of one God. And we take other gods besides God. And we live lives as we wish. Jesus didn't eat pork, but for us it's okay. It's nice, it's sweet. We go our own way. Jesus' women, they covered themselves up. Like Mary is always shown, covered up. Like the Muslim women today. But we say, no. I want to show my hair. I spend all this money at the beauty parlor, I can't show my hair. What's the point? You know? I want men to look at me and say, wow. You know? This is the path that we have chosen. If this is what we want, this is the way that we choose, that is the path to health. It is as simple as that. Okay. If you have any questions you'd like to ask concerning slander in the Quran, welcome.
In the two hadith you mentioned, the Prophet ﷺ said about your brother, about your brother, that which he would dislike, or to eat the dead flesh of your brother, in the Quran. Does that mean then that, for example, if we say Michael Jackson is a paedophile, is this now backbiting or slander, or does it only concern the believers?
To speak ill about anybody is prohibited in Islam. Your brother in humanity. If we are just saying evil to say evil, you know, just for something to say, to fill in our conversation, then it is evil. Because Islam doesn't make a distinction between those who are believers. So you don't speak bad about believers, but disbelievers you can say anything about them. No. If you are using, for example, that example of that person to teach others, for example, I'm talking about the breakdown in the morality of America. And I say, well, in the past, fidelity was very important, chastity. It was inconceivable that a president of America be openly known to commit adultery or fornication. But today, Clinton, before his election, it came out. He was committing adultery with, you know, his aides, etc., etc., etc. But the American people still elected him as the president of the country. What is that? That is saying, it's all right. What he does in his personal life is his business. So I speak about Bill Clinton in that way. one could say. Isn't that backbiting? No. I'm using it to illustrate a point. This is not something which is not known to the world. It's in the headlines, in the newspapers, etc. To illustrate a point, to warn people of this danger. So when it is used in that fashion for educational purposes, like Allah in the Quran speaks of the people of old, of the people of Lot, you know, to speak of those, the trials and tribulations which came to them, for a message, for a lesson to be learned, no, this is permissible. It's not considered to then be backbiting. But when people just sit around and they just want to say something, just something to say, and these things are talked about, you see, it's not good, because what happens is that if this becomes just the norm in our conversation, talking about these things that are happening to the evil of others, etc., then to shift from that into slander about believers and others, this becomes easy, because we're getting into the habit, you know. So in Islam, we're encouraged to stay away from that whole area. I have a question which is related to that issue of Lot, concerning homosexuality. Homosexuality meaning a woman or a man who takes another woman or another man as a wife or a husband, having sexual relations with them. This is something which is spreading in the world today. A major disease. A disease which, in the time of Prophet Lot, where it first began, in Sodom and Gomorrah, where people chose this way, God destroyed those people. He destroyed those cities because of this major evil. This evil which has produced in our own times the sickness of AIDS and other sicknesses which plague mankind today. This is something which we will be punished for in this life and also in the next. It is going against the nature which God created us with. Some people try to argue that, well, you know, these people are naturally inclined this way. No. They have become inclined this way. They have chosen this way. God created us in a particular form. Created our bodies in such a way that that relationship is normal between man and woman, not between man and man or woman and woman. If it were to be any other way, then our bodies would naturally be made in such a way that these kind of relationships could not only happen but bring fruit. Because what is the fruit of this relationship? The fruit is children. No man with another man can produce a child, or any woman with another woman. So there is no fruit coming out of that. That is a barren relationship. It is a relationship which goes against nature, which was created by God. And it is in fact a rejection of the law of God. It is something which is cursed in the scriptures, in the law of Moses. The punishment for such is death. It is written in the law that those found in such activities were to be killed. God commanded that because it is a major evil. And if we are to believe in God, it is our duty to accept the commandments of God, regardless of how we might feel inclined. Every individual may have desires. Not may, but does. These desires, if they are channeled in the correct fashion, are pleasing to God and are rewarded by God. But if they are not channeled in the correct direction, then they are evil, they are despised by God, and we will be punished for them. Control of our desires. As we spoke in this chapter about control of our desire for wealth, our desire to live forever. These desires, as we must control them, we must also control our physical desires. And use those desires only in the channels which God has permitted. Any further questions?
Why Islam permits the science to find or discover medicine for the cure, and why some other religions rejecting this concept, and in their teaching what their doctrines like faith healing, and why they are performing this faith healing instead of find a medicine for the cure?
Why? Islam, as we said, recognizes the realities of this life, that both disease and cure come from God ultimately. Knowledge which produces good is from God. Whatever we discover of the laws in nature, these are laws which God set. And the whole of creation was placed there for our benefit. So we are encouraged, Islam encourages research, taking from the world around us that which is beneficial. It does not say that ultimately we shouldn't have faith in God. Because when a person takes a medicine, we are to say, in the name of God. We take this medicine in the name of God, believing that this medicine will only benefit us if God permits it to benefit us. If it has been destined that it will benefit us, then it will. And this is by the will of God. To believe that this benefit is going to benefit us no matter what. We don't even have to think of God, we just take it, it's going to help us. This is actually a form of shirk. This is putting our trust, ultimate trust in other than God, that good or evil can be, evil can be prevented or good can be gotten without the aid of God. So faith healing in Islam is a reality, but it is not divorced from science. That we heal ourselves through the means of science where possible, having faith in God that it will help us, and being patient if it doesn't. That is true faith healing. But now, going to somebody who says, by me laying my hands on your body, you will get well, your cancer will be cured, this and that. Now, this is nonsense. It is trickery. And it is a means to plunder the wealth of innocence. People who cannot afford to go to the doctor but can give a few pesos to the faith healer, you know, maybe they're not asking for it straight away, but after you've been healed, or what you thought you were healed, then you have to give something. This is satanic. This is evil, exploitation. And Islam is opposed to it. Though, as I said, ultimately, health, good health, or bad health, is by the permission of God. So we should have faith. Have faith in God. We try to treat ourselves the best we can. And in the end, we should keep our trust firmly in God. And if it is His will that we will be cured, then nothing can stop us from being cured. But if it is His will, His destiny, that we will remain sick, then nothing can cure us. That is the reality. People will go to the faith healer, and the mind, you know, we not know what's called mind over matter. The mind can play tricks on the body. People who are involved in hypnosis, they demonstrate that. They will hypnotize a person, and in that state of hypnosis, they will tell them, we are going to put this hot spoon on your hand. They have a regular spoon, not hot or anything. They will put it on the person's hand, and a welt will come up, just as if you put a hot spoon. That's mind over matter. But it wasn't a hot spoon. Your body has reacted, but it wasn't a hot spoon. So if you put enough faith on that person, for the moment, or for some moments, you may feel cured. Right? Because you put your strong faith in that person. And they touch you, you feel it. And usually many times they have, you know, they will have little electrodes and things hooked up, so when they touch you, you feel a buzz. You know, your body's like this. You know, you fall down and you get up, you know, you feel really something has happened here. You know, you're changed now. You think yourself better. And in fact, you're not really better. But your mind can give you that impression. And this is how they play on people. You know, people, the mind. And they, of course, they take wealth from these people. People who cannot afford. Further questions?
Why Muslims don't eat pork?
Why Muslims don't eat pork? Well, to say why Muslims don't eat pork, we should need to say why don't the followers of the prophets eat pork? Because some people think it's just Muslims who don't eat pork. But no. Prophet Moses, Prophet Abraham, Prophet Jesus, David, all of the prophets taught not eating pork. And Jesus never put a piece of pork in his mouth. When people came to him who were possessed by evil spirits, if you read the gospel, and he exorcised them, removed those spirits, the spirits asked to go into the pigs. There were some pigs on a mountainside. And he allowed them to go into the pigs, and the pigs ran into the sea and drowned. This is in the gospel. Why did God command through the prophets that we not eat pork? He commanded it because there is harm in it. God did not forbid us from anything in which the good in it is greater than the harm in it. There is good in everything. But there are some things that the evil in it is greater than the good. And because of that, God forbids it. Actually, in the Quran, God speaks about alcohol. And He said, in it, there is benefit for people. Those who sell it, those who grow the grapes or the whatever, and then they sell the crops that they make the alcohol, they're benefiting. There's benefit in it. But the evil in it is greater than the benefit. And this is why God forbade it. Alcohol. Similarly, with the pig, I know. Our guests here who are still eating the pig, and those of us who converted to Islam, which is most of us here, we know before Islam we were eating the pig. And it tasted okay. Right? However, God informed us that there is harm in the pig. He didn't go into detail to tell us what is the harm, exactly where is the harm, etc. And people have done research on the pig, etc. and shown that many diseases are carried by the pig. If you read about trichinosis, this is one disease particular to the pig, passed on by the pig. Trichinosis, a worm which grows in the flesh of the pig. A worm which when you cook it, when you cook the flesh on the normal stove, it doesn't kill that worm. You have to cook it at extremely high temperatures. Like what is in like a bakery or a big oven that reach high temperatures to kill that, these worms. And the doctors, when they deal with people who have heart problems, clogged arteries, cholesterol, fatty deposits in their arteries, the first thing they will tell such people is stop eating the pig. Why? Because the pig is one of the biggest sources for fatty deposits in the body. So we can see these obvious physical harms. But we know in Islam there is a principle. The Prophet forbade us from eating any animals which eat other animals. The carnivorous animals. Birds or beasts. Carnivorous animals. The animals that we are allowed to eat are the vegetarians. The cow, the sheep, goats, etc. The vegetarians. Why? Because there is something in the nature of the carnivore. Remember, a lion is not... When you see a lion, if you've ever seen movies of a lion killing a deer, for example, its food, when it wants to kill a food, it is very savage. The deer is running along, the lion jumps on it and it starts tearing it up and biting and clawing and very horrible looking, you know, very savage thing. Why? You think that the lion, he chooses, you know, one day he eats some grass and some fruit, then another day he feels vicious, so he goes out and he tears up. No. This is the nature of the lion. He is like that by his nature. Even people who take lions, right? They take little baby lions or tigers, and they're looking like a little kitten. When they're first born, they look like a kitten. They raise them in their homes, you know. They feed them regular food, everything else, and they're very tame. But what you find is that one day, that tame tiger or lion, when he gets bigger, he'll reach out and claw, or he'll bite. You know, and it's like, wow, why he bit me? Here's that thing, I've been raising him for so long. Or in the, you see in the circuses, the lion trainer,
trains the lion. You know, he has the lion open up his jaws, he puts his head in there, you know, everybody, whoa, you know. But one day the jaw closes and that lion trainer is dead. It happens every year around the world, in different parts of the world, people are involved, they're getting killed by the animals they're training. Why? Because it is the nature of the lion to be like that. This is something within its chromosomes, it's within the genes of the body. Every cell has that imprinted in there. And as a famous German nutritionist said, you are what you eat. Whatever you eat, your body breaks it down, then it remakes itself from the same material. Isn't it? Whatever you eat, your body breaks it down in the digestive system, then it absorbs the molecules back into the body and makes up the rest of your body. Has any of you observed the pig? How the pig lives, its ways? Very horrible. So, Islam, in order to preserve us, the Prophet's teachings from God, in order to preserve us from the evil effects of eating the pig, forbade us from eating it. I know some of you will say, then why did God create the pig? If it wasn't to eat, why did He create it? I can say to you, well, why did He create spiders? Do we go and eat spiders too? No. It doesn't mean everything is created, you should just go and eat it. We have some guests here, non-Muslim guests. Actually, I want to hear one question from you. You're Muslim? I want... No. Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh. Oh, you'll embrace Islam today. Okay.
But before, brother, I yeah. ask for your permission. Why Islam, before I answer, why Islam, they don't prohibit that the path, the lizard,
why does Islam prohibit the dog who can? Huh?
They don't want the cat, the dog, and the lizard.
One, the cat is not prohibited. The Prophet himself said to allow the cats to roam. They can come in the house, out the house, etc. As long as they're clean, you keep them clean, whatever, they're okay.
They don't want that you're going to the cat or give them food.
To the cat?
Yeah.
No. This maybe you observe some Muslim carrying like that. Okay, that's personal. But this is not the way of Islam. The way of Islam, it is nice to the cats. It will feed the cats. People will keep cats, etc., etc. No harm about the cats. Now the dog, Islam again, does not say that we should be, you know, evil to dogs. Right? Islam says that we have dogs for three purposes. I know in other society the dog is man's best friend. So people sleep with the dog. You see people kissing dogs. You see people leaving their money for dogs. They die and instead of leaving their wealth for children, they leave it for dogs. You know? In Islam, it says we have dogs for three purposes. We can keep them for three purposes. One, as watchdogs to protect our home, protect our area from harm. Two, as sheep